Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Welcome back to another installment of Progress Note.
That's right. I'm Jack.
I'm Riley.
And together we are.
Trying to make it work, trying to hold it
Okay.
together.
Okay. Just pushing through.
Now, today we have a really exciting one for you, though. We have a phenomenal guest who we have been very fortunate to learn from throughout the last couple of years.
Yeah, she's been a very important part of our preclinical years, especially. We were lucky enough to have her in one of the classes that we take here at UConn School of Medicine, which kind of revolves around imaging and some diagnostic studies. And her expertise, where she is the master, is ultrasound.
Yes. So today we have the one, the only, Dr. Megan Herbst
Woo-woo.
of the University of Connecticut.
Proud.
She is currently still a practicing emergency department physician here at UConn, trained here. He went to medical school here, residency here, and then did a fellowship in ultrasound at Yale. And she spends the majority of her time now, or the majority of her days, doing administrative and educational roles, but still works a decent bit of clinical overnight emergency medicine shifts.
Right. And she spends the minority of her time sleeping.
Yeah, there's almost none of it.
Not even minority of her day sleeping. It's kind of like minority of her week sleeping. She's crazy. She's unstoppable. She's, what's a good comparison? The Mike Tyson
Of
of
ultrasound.
ultrasound in her life.
I like that.
I don't know. We probably, Mike Tyson, he is pretty badass.
He was pretty badass. So is she,
Still
but I
is,
feel like
yeah.
she's a little bit more sound-minded.
Yeah, she wouldn't knock people out. Well,
Talk trash about ultrasound. Might find out.
yeah, don't mess with her and the crystals.
But no, today we talk a lot about her path into getting so heavily specialized in such a unique area, how her niche has molded her adventure through medicine, how ultrasound has been growing, evolving, and what it looks like in terms of the future. And then we actually did a lot of story time today, right?
Yeah, that was really cool. This was like just a fly on the wall of a conversation that we got to have with her, which was really cool.
Yeah, a lot of interesting stories. So, for anyone who's interested in kind of just medicine as a specialty, because like all of these stories are exactly what you hear about out of like a novel or out of Grey's Anatomy. And she's lived through it, she's passing on those lessons to us. And so, we can't wait for you guys to hear what she's got to say.
Yeah, tune in.
All right. Without further ado.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Well, thank you so much for hopping on with us. I know this is kind of a big ask, especially with your schedule.
Oh, no, it's not a big ask. I'm happy to do whatever makes you guys happy. I hope I make you proud. I'm definitely not a I have no stage presence or yeah,
It's
just tell
perfect. We
me what
have a humongous audience. We had our Spotify wrapped. Do you have Spotify?
I do not, but I did look up. I like heard your interview of Dr. Regan. I think there were some people in Boston.
Awesome.
Yeah.
But so on Spotify, every year at the end of the year, they do like a gift wrapped thing where they show you who you listen to the most in terms of your music. And then for podcast hosts, it shows you how many people listen to you throughout the year and how many countries and stuff. And if you can believe it, we were the number one podcast for 8 listeners last year.
8 whole people.
So don't be too scared with your stage.
Okay. That's actually, that makes me feel very comfortable. Thank you.
That's why we tried to talk Dr. Baldwin into coming on too. And I think he's a little bit scared that we have way more listeners than we do.
Maybe I can convince him. Cause I feel like, I wonder if he goes through the same thing as me. Like you could put me in front of hundreds of people and I would have no problem talking about ultrasound, like zero problem, but like interview style, like that's recorded. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah.
It's all right. We'll ask a lot about ultrasound today then.
Oh, sweet. That's definitely a comfort zone.
Exactly.
Yeah. One of our other best friends is Dave Cannata. So we've heard a lot about all the good stuff that you guys are doing.
He's a great student.
He's pretty
decent. As many of you are.
Yes,
he's well decent.
And he always tells us about doing these overnight shifts with you. And it's just crazy. You only work overnight shifts or primarily, is that still right?
Yeah, it's primarily, almost exclusively night shifts.
How do you do that?
So I'm trying to think back. My son is 10, and I remember when we found out we were going to have a family, we were both in shock a little bit. Not that we didn't, you know, anticipate it was going to happen at some point, but we both had very full work schedules. And one of the adjustments I think we made was, because I wasn't exclusively nights before having my son, but we kind of transitioned to that because our children are sleeping obviously at night, and it's much easier to have in-laws come and stay in the guest room, or some people have in-law, you know, apartments, which we did not think that far ahead. And that way, our in-laws, you know, if they have a bad dream, they can comfort them. But it's much different than having someone come in your house during the day and have to chase around your children, especially if they're not, you know, as fast or maybe not as quick as some of my children are mentally and physically. And so, that helped. But I'm also a morning person. So that might not make sense. You know, why are you working nights if you're a morning person? So when I'm not working clinically, I get up like between 3 and 4 in the morning. I find that's like my, that's when I think clearest, and I know everybody else is usually sleeping around that time. So I feel like nobody can interrupt and I can get stuff done. But like 8 PM is like my worst, and I'm like probably the most tired around 8 PM. So by working daytime and working overnights, I protect my evenings for, you know, my low mental zone time. And also we can have dinner as a family, which is something that was really important to me, is like making sure we can all sit together. I didn't think about sports and things that have kind of intruded a little bit, but we still will have dinner together, whether it's like 5 p.m. or like 8:30 p.m., depending on the season. So I just don't work evenings, and unless I'm covering for someone sick, or which is not usually someone else who loves evenings, I'll do that. I'll cover day shifts and night shifts.
Oh, that's interesting. Wait, so when do you sleep?
So
it sounds like your schedule is pretty booked. I don't know if there's much.
I'm looking for hours in the day right now.
So contrary to popular belief, I do sleep. If I have worked, let's see. So if I'm about to work a night, like so tomorrow night I will work overnight clinically. I will still get up at my usual time. Actually, we have a 7:30 a.m. department meeting that's in person tomorrow. So I'll get up at my usual time. I'll get stuff done during the day. I will work overnight. I do try to lay down with my kids, you know, and just have like a rest period. I don't always sleep during that time. And then I'll work. And at that point, shoot, I hope future patients aren't listening to this. I hope, you know, there is science that says that, you know, sleep deprivation is similar to like an intoxicated state. But you're not aware of it. It's kind of like, I don't know if that makes sense. You know how you can be intoxicated, but you don't think you're intoxicated. Mm-hmm. You can, anyway, so that's not good. And I'm aware of that. So I do try to rest, meditate, be efficient about rest. I'll work. And then I might get a few things done after my shift because adrenaline's usually high after a clinical shift. And then, oh my goodness, it's like the best sleep ever. It's like when you sleep after you're up, and you probably, now that you're doing rotations and stuff, I don't, you do 24 hour shifts, right?
Really? Surgery. Yeah.
Surgery.
And you're on that now, right? Are you doing your surgical rotations now?
I'm on OB. Yeah. I'm on OB. And so I start, we have our shelf Friday actually. And then, I start at Hartford on Monday in surgery.
Great. Okay. Oh, the surgical group at Hartford. They've got great people.
I'm excited. We just got our schedule. And I'm going to be on trauma for 4 weeks. And then you have 2 weeks of either vascular or elective.
Oh yeah.
Which is pretty cool.
Wow, that's sick.
So it's exciting because it kind of combines, like, we've done a lot of work together, and you know that I'm interested in emergency medicine, and then I also really like the operative side of things that I'm starting to realize. So it kind of merges both of those fields together, which is super unique, and I'm super excited to see that.
It's gonna be a lot of fun. It's gonna be a very busy service. I think you're gonna love it. And are you gonna do vascular or elective?
I'm not really decided yet. I probably will do at least 1 week of vascular since we have the 2 weeks, and okay. Not sure what I would do for the second week, but I'll probably try and meet somebody there and see what I get, like, kind of most drawn to.
Do some EFAS during your trauma, like be assertive.
Yeah.
Make friends with the residents, and they'll let you do it.
The biggest thing that I have realized is that scrub techs are the greatest resource a student can ever have. They are so good to us. Like, this is good for when you get in.
Yeah.
Please, like, just immediately make friends with them. They are the nicest, sweetest, and they will always give you advice on how to look less bad.
They're in the end. Yeah, you gotta befriend them for sure.
But yeah, so I'm super excited about that. And we're going to do, I think, 3 24-hour shifts during the rotation.
So when you sleep after being up, it's like, honestly, it's a very good feeling. I feel like I've like maybe lifted people's expectations, but it's best sleep I get.
Yeah, your normal week, how many shifts would you do?
It's really only about 2 a week is what it works out to be, depending on like what else is going on, what I need, you know, they may not work out to exactly 2 a week. They might get shifted. Some weeks I might be away at a conference. Some weeks, lately I'm trying to get the schedule for the first and second year ultrasound sessions, because they're like over 20 hours sometimes when you have first and second years all at the same time. So I've learned over the years, okay, when is this coming up? Let me make sure I'm not working the night before. Because I think also some first years are having some interesting impressions of me if I'm post night and meeting them. So
so was it always that way with your shifts, or I'm assuming you kind of transitioned more into this administrative educational role?
Yeah, when I came to UConn, briefly it was like 80% nights and a few day shifts, but one of my colleagues who was working night shifts made the decision at some point while I was here that she didn't want to do night shifts anymore for a very good reason. And so the other people doing nights kind of took over her shifts. And that wasn't long after I started. I started at UConn primarily in 2017. Okay. Up until that time, I was at Hartford pretty exclusively, but still had med students doing ultrasound rotations and tried to interact with them, especially third and fourth years, as much as possible.
Yeah, that's great. I was always curious because
when we do our introduction for this, we are absolutely going to be introducing you as the queen of ultrasound. So first off, just be prepared for that. Second off, like, how did that get to be such a big part of your repertoire? Because now being on the educational side of things, and like you were just saying, how much exposure you give to the current students, I feel like that's such a perfect niche that is growing so expansively and so quickly, mm-hmm. that you were kind of on the front of that train. Is that the right phrase?
Yeah.
Front of that train.
Sure.
Front of that. I don't know.
I'm definitely the queen of watching impressions for sure. So yeah, I follow what you're giving me. Yeah, so I got really lucky, I think, in terms of the timing, even though ultrasound has been used, right, for decades before I was in medicine. I think it really picked up around the time that I was a resident. So yeah, when I was a resident, this is like, I don't know, should I give away dates?
Yes.
Probably not. when I was a resident about roughly 15 years ago, I was a resident 15 years ago. We'll say that. I won't say when I started or when I finished.
there you go. We have a whole few years to decipher between.
Yeah, exactly. There really wasn't much ultrasound curriculum. There was like an introductory lecture for first years, and the machines were kept kind of in a closet area. And I remember there was a guy at Hartford in Green Pod who he coughed and he had groin pain. And we had just gotten this introductory talk, and it was actually mostly around gallbladders. So I was like, oh, well, I just learned about this thing, and you can like look inside the body and it's like no radiation. And I found it. There was a student in the department who was just looking for stuff to do. And I, before I got the ultrasound, actually, sorry, I got to tell the story, right? He coughed and he felt groin pain. And immediately I looked at the student like outside the room and I said, okay, what do you think is going on? And we were both thinking this sounded like a hernia. And so I was like, have you ever done a hernia exam before? And she said, no. And I said, okay, well, let's go in together. Like, this is how you do it. You go first and then I'll do it. And then we should be all set. We'll have our diagnosis. And so she went ahead and did the exam. She's like, I didn't feel anything. And then I did the exam and I didn't feel anything, but he was like really tender in that area. So that's when I said, okay, let's go find this thing that looks inside the body. And I found it in a closet, and I remember also I didn't know how to turn it on because they hadn't talked about how to turn on the machine. And I was like looking all over the machine. There was like a little tag on it with a metal wire. And I thought for some reason I had to undo that to get into like how to turn it on. And I was underneath the machine, and another attending like walked by and saw me like underneath the ultrasound machine and kind of walked in, turned it on, and then left the room.
Nice.
And I was like, thank you. And I looked and expecting to see, I didn't even know what I was expecting to see, but what I saw was this anechoic or black collection that was growing. And for, I know you guys are aware of, but black or anechoic on ultrasound is fluid, and it looked bad. And you could see kind of like this turbulent flow pattern right over where his pain was. And so long story short, this guy was on Coumadin and he had this expanding hematoma. And because of the ultrasound, even though we didn't know what we were looking at, we knew that something was very wrong with that, that picture. And we got into CT and we had to end up like the CT confirmed what we, you know, were kind of thinking at that point. And we reversed his blood thinners, and yeah, it was crazy. And I was like, oh my God. And I looked at the student and I remember like that was really cool. And then I just taught myself. Like I remember conference was only, now it's 5 hours once a week. It was 4 hours once a week. And I'd have this like voluntary thing with the residents, like, hey, if anybody just wants to nerd out with me, like I've been doing some scans and like teaching myself, and I want to share it with everybody. And I definitely it was kind of a community learning together thing that we started. And yeah, then I did a fellowship and I found out like how a real ultrasound curriculum could be. And my residency experience was like so phenomenal. It was even better than my college experience, which also is very nerdy, that I wanted to give back to the program. So I did the fellowship to bring ultrasound back to the residency, built a curriculum with the residency. And then once that was on autopilot and I had like some of my fellows stayed to be faculty, and now we have additional faculty too, Dr. Lauterman, Dr. Chago, Dr. Wise, Dr. Shea came after I went to UConn, which has been a huge addition. I felt to the point where I could expand to the med school, which is even cooler in some ways, as much as I still get to see the residents, which I don't think I could leave them completely ever. But the med students, just knowing that everybody's going to different specialties and they'll have ultrasound, like some ultrasound foundation, is really rewarding, because so many people use ultrasound incorrectly. And believe me, like I've made all the mistakes like in my road. So kind of preventing that and having physicians understand like, okay, I know how to use ultrasound, as opposed to like, I used ultrasound and it didn't work. Ultrasound is terrible. Or, you know, I think it's just misinterpreted or people don't understand limitations. So hopefully people can use it in the right way.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so cool. I've seen, it seems like we have a bunch of practice materials for a lot of the different tests that we take and whatnot. And a lot of them are available because they're like years past practice exams, and you get these different forms, maybe for like USMLE. And going from the earlier forms that are maybe 5 years ago, or maybe even earlier, I've seen like an increasing number of correct answers that are like, what's the first diagnostic test or study that you want to do for a certain condition? It's like ultrasound is now moving up into that, especially with a lot of our pediatrics things, it seemed like. So I think that's really cool. Also, you mentioned Dr. Shea. One of my best friends is a PA at Hartford in the emergency department, and he is starting to do more ultrasound stuff. So that I think, I don't know if it's like an accreditation or maybe just an extra training that he wants to do, but he says that you and Dr. Shea are like the masters of ultrasound, like all the cool stuff that you guys have been able to do and develop there. So I just want to share that too. So he's been awesome. Nerding out about it too. Yeah.
What's his name? If you feel comfortable.
Yeah. PA Chris Shimwell.
Okay. Chris Shimwell. Got it. Chris Shimwell.
Yeah. He's like kind of blondish, a little dorky looking. That's my best friend. I can make fun of him.
Okay. Awesome. I'll look out for him.
I don't think I realized that a lot of other medical curriculums don't entail as much detail as we get on ultrasound.
Yeah.
I was talking to my other friends from some of the other medical schools, mainly on the East Coast, but a lot of them were saying they really don't get any exposure. And I just kind of thought, based on its versatility and everything that we learn about it and how useful it has already been in all of our rotations, that everyone would be learning about this. But apparently,
that's really
yeah.
So okay, a couple things. First of all, like I'm so happy that you're using on your rotations, because this has been like one of my favorite mentors always told me, like it's a marathon, it's not a sprint, which I try to think of every day, just because, you know, when you discover something great, you want things to change like immediately. And so I know over the past like long time, it's been slow kind of making its way through to clerkships. So it makes me really happy that you're using them on clerkships. I'd love to hear your stories. But yeah, in terms of like other medical schools, it's I know from my reading in the literature, it seems, and talking with my colleagues in other places, like it's definitely expanding. The last number I heard, I mean, it's close to 70% of medical schools, and that might be dated. I don't know whether that in that 70%, though, is like, you know, an elective and ultrasound is included, or it's a mandatory vertical curriculum, because I think it's everywhere from, you know, an optional thing all the way to required in EM only to required across all 4 years. And I think that's what needs to continue to improve.
Yeah. What would you say for, I guess, students now who might be listening to this, What are the advantages and benefits to learning a skill like ultrasound early on?
Oh my God. Well, first of all, it's becoming, if not already, a requirement across a lot of residencies. I feel like almost every residency is going to require some specialized ultrasound utilization, with the exception of psychiatry, which is kind of funny.
You found a way to ultrasound the brain. Yeah. We're getting there.
You can. No, you can totally ultrasound the brain. So actually, okay, step back. Peds, because I know there's some peds interest in this like little circle here. You can absolutely do brain scans on neonates. You can also look for skull fractures in pediatrics. And then even all the way up through adulthood, neurosurgeons use ultrasound like through the temporal bone, which is this, it's the thinnest bone. You use like a phased array or sector transducer, which is like lower frequency, and you put color Doppler on, and you can actually see the pulsation of the middle cerebral artery coming towards the temporal bone. And then you put spectral Doppler, and I won't get too into physics, but oh, by the way, today I recorded a physics talk for second year medical students that I'm not sure I should make live yet because it's still very nerdy, but maybe I'll send it to you for reference.
I would love that. Did it put their brains into like a vortex? I feel like at some point when you start bringing more physics into medical school, we're all just totally
zonked out. Yes, I know. I think I need to make it better. I tried. I listened to it though, and I was like, not totally happy with it yet. You could be my test audience, but so you can actually, so spectral Doppler will tell you the exact velocity of that blood flow coming towards the temporal bone. So the end of this story is if like you have a subarachnoid hemorrhage, for example, and you've got spasm of that middle cerebral artery, then the velocity is going to go up, right? So you can actually detect higher velocity, which would indicate, you know, arterial spasm, which would be concerning for intracranial bleeding. And that's probably just one of many applications, but you can see the brain. I don't know how we got on that. You have to get me back.
Honestly, I don't know. But it just...
Psychiatry.
Yes. No, it just goes to show the versatility of it. Like, it's in every single field that you could be interested in, again, maybe except for psychiatry so far. But, like, all students will benefit from having that sort of background, no matter what you want to go into.
Definitely.
Right. And I think there's kind of like this reverse learning curve where, unlike other things, where the attendings you're working with are like, they are the wealth of knowledge, right? With ultrasound, there's like this reverse phenomenon, which I noticed when I was first at the residency, where I'm teaching the residents all this ultrasound, but some of my colleagues who are not ultrasound fellowship trained had no ultrasound experience. So what ended up happening was, and it's hard to get a full-fledged attending to learn something new. You know, there's like what you can't teach an old dog new tricks, which there are definitely exceptions to that, including like the chair of the emergency department when I started at Hartford was like my biggest supporter. And I don't think I would be where I am without him. He was the best boss ever, and he was super supportive, and he learned better. And he like retired a couple years after I started, and he learned everything. And his name was AJ Smalley, and he's like the best ever. Anyway, but mostly I was teaching the residents, and then the residents were like either using it and then presenting to their attendings, or they were like, oh, I'm going to do an ultrasound. Do you want to supervise me? And that was the motivation for the attendings to come be like, you have to teach me this because I have no idea. As opposed to like, oh, you should learn this because it's like new and it's up and coming. There's much less motivation. But when the residents are more knowledgeable than the attending, I think one of two things happens. Either the attending, you know, just gets very vocal, like this should not be taught, which that's not going to work with ultrasound for very long. Or they just, they're a closet scanner, or they're just, you know, they want to learn. And so I think that's also going to happen in terms of students using ultrasound, is because it's becoming required in residencies. What I'm finding is a lot of even residency faculty, they're like, okay, we need to teach ultrasound, but we have nobody to teach it right now. And so the more of a foundation a student can have, the better they're going to learn it and help their fields. It's really going to be like this reverse learning curve, like this kind of the younger teaches the, or the less, how are we going to say it? Younger teaches the older, or less experienced teaches the more experienced in a way.
Mm. Oh, that's so interesting. I do wonder too about, I know there's been some issues regarding like interpretation, like if you're doing point of care, because if you're trained in it and you're looking at whatever you want to find right there, and you kind of, you have a good sense of what's going on in this diagnosis, do you still need maybe somebody else to look at it and also agree with your interpretation before you treat? Like, is there a radiologist involved with that image, or how does that work?
Oh, that's a great question. So point of care ultrasound by definition is completely different than like a radiology interpretation of a technician performed ultrasound. Does that make sense? Because radiologists, well, depending on where their residency training was, they may have had experience doing the ultrasound, but typically a technician is getting very specific views of very specific structures like gallbladder, maybe a DVT study. Those are the two most common radiology ultrasound applications. Oh, and the pelvis in a female. Mm-hmm. And then the radiologist will look at those very specific images as well as the technician interpretation and interpret based on that. But most of the time, a radiologist is reading x-rays, CTs, and MRIs, maybe nuclear scans, depending on the training of the radiologist. But the CT and MR studies, that's what's the most lucrative and the most common in their field. That's really, they call themselves the doctor's doctors, which is really true. Like if I'm going to get a CT, it's like I've come to this point. Usually ultrasound is incorporated. Like I have this hashtag ultrasound first with my history and exam. I've got my differential, right? And I need, in some cases, I need like CT to give me like to either confirm this diagnosis that I shouldn't confirm or can't confirm with the resources I have, or I'm down to two differentials and I really need the CT, or I'm admitting the patient and they need that CT imaging.
Okay.
So radiology is definitely different. If radiology looked at the stuff that we save, it's all video. They're all 4 second Cineloops that just like loop, and we interpret based on landmarks. So I don't always get a coronal, axial, sagittal, perfect image that's all prepared like on a silver platter for someone else to read. I look, okay, I know where I am because of anatomic landmarks, which is why we focus on that in first and second year of med school. And then I am in this moment trying to make a decision. So I've got a hypotensive patient, and I have no idea why their blood pressure is low. There was no trauma. And I do an aorta scan and there's no abdominal aortic aneurysm. And I do a cardiac scan and the left ventricular function is excellent and there's no pericardial effusion. And their IVC is flat. And I do a fast exam and it's positive. So immediately I'm now thinking they are bleeding out. Do they have a spontaneous aneurysm rupture, like a splenic artery aneurysm rupture, or I've had pancreatic or duodenal aneurysm ruptures. These things are rare, but like, are they, I had a liver cirrhosis patient who fell at home, was vomiting and having diarrhea, like some sort of GI bug, and like got lightheaded, fell, and sustained a liver lack from the fall, right? But it sounded more like, you just get these cloudy stories like, oh, GI bug, it got lightheaded, is coming in because of a GI bug, but they're hypotensive. And without the ultrasound image, you might think, oh, it's just dehydration. And then you look at the belly and it's belly full of blood. Mm-hmm. Anyway, if I were to be at the bedside in someone with hypotension and said, oh, hey, radiology, can you come down and do this scan like in the next 30 seconds? Because the patient's going to die if you don't. Nobody's going to stop what they're doing and come down. It's really on the physician taking care of the patient.
Mm-hmm.
And it really, sorry, I hope I'm not getting too far from the question, but.
I like the stories. It ties everything together, which remind me, I have like some good ultrasound stories I want to tell you from.
Yeah.
They're fantastic.
Well, okay, so maybe this is a good time to pause and just talk about like ultrasound stories, but ultimately I'll like finish answering the question Jack had, and then I want to hear stories from you guys. Yeah. But ultimately, the physician sometimes needs to do the ultrasound to get to a differential, so they're not ordering like a bunch of CTs or the wrong study, which inundates the radiologist with unnecessary imaging, which makes their read cheaper. And it also dilutes, like, you know, at some point a radiologist might be timing themselves like, okay, I'm going to have hundreds of studies over my shift. If I spend more than a minute on each study, I'm going to be behind. So I have to get through it. So we want to protect our radiologists. And then Jack, I guess just bring me back to what to do. Because when you're a learner, no, you can't bill for it. You shouldn't make decisions on it. In the learning phase, you need to do it and you need to order a confirmatory study. Mm-hmm. Okay. But maybe the ultrasound will help lead you to that confirmatory study and change the order that you order stuff, if that makes any sense. Yeah. Okay, I'm done with that rant.
Yeah. Okay, so ultrasound stories from residency.
Oh baby.
Should we start with our shared companion?
Sure. Wait, from residency?
Nope, from rotation.
Oh. From rotation.
Yeah. I was gonna say you got promoted. It's exciting.
Yeah, we oh, I wish. Yeah, so our shared one was actually during inpatient pediatrics. We're both on red team, so MS-8 at Connecticut Children's. And he was, yeah, he was on the rotation right before mine. So a lot of the patients that he saw, they were there for long term. I kind of took over, which was really cool. So we had this one patient who has, I think it was a factor 8. So he had hemophilia, he had factor 8, but he also developed an inhibitor to factor 9. So all of his kind of treatment got really complicated. And so for him, we ended up using ultrasound all the time because he was having frequent intra-articular bleeds. And so ultrasound was the best way instead of like radiating him all the time. But just picking up, he'd be like, oh, I bumped my elbow like playing video games this morning. He's like, oh my gosh. All right. So we'll come and we'll get the point of care ultrasound, take a look and see, and then kind of treat accordingly, ice packs and then other medications. So that one was really interesting. I used it probably on like my second day on the rotation, which was really cool. And then quite frequently other than that, it was just, I think that's probably the extent of what I had been involved with, other than seeing studies ordered like super often, especially in the emergency department after, you know, looking at somebody's chart and seeing after they've been admitted to a certain medicine floor or something like that. The other one that I mentioned to Riley.
That example that you gave is huge because, I mean, he could have a severe bleed, right? Intra-articular bleed. And I mean, I don't know how large this kid is. I mean, some people would say, oh, physical exam, like you would know physical examination, which in some cases, if it's a huge bleed and it's a child, like thin child, maybe, but just to confirm it, or if you've got a larger patient, you know, there are, you know, in the United States of America, a huge obese population in our country. And sometimes physical examination is not, you know, I don't know who's listening to this again, but it's just not chopped up. But we should always do it. Like, just like ultrasound isn't as good as CT, right? Like physical examination, we should lay hands on a patient. We should examine the patient, right? Ultrasound's like just so much better. And then anyway, so that's a great, like super awesome example because it takes a few seconds to just take a look and be sure or rule it out.
And to go on that point and to actually like kind of improve what you're trying to say in correlation to this, I was there when we had the first physical. I actually did his first physical exam when he had the intra-articular hemorrhage by myself because he was my patient, so I was rounding on him. And it was kind of hard to tell because it really wasn't a drastic hemorrhage, right? So he has this, he's in for the factor 8 deficiency with the factor 9 inhibitors. So we know he's really prone to bleeding, but then he was just like, yeah, my elbow is a little bit like painful, but I didn't bump it or anything. And like, this happens sometimes. And then it usually just goes away. And I was like, okay. And I like was checking the range of motion and it wasn't really that limited. There wasn't much pain. It wasn't really erythematous, no changes in temperature or anything.
Yeah.
And so I was like, it doesn't seem like anything super big. It's normal for him. He has these episodes, but I'm still going to bring it up either way. And as soon as I brought it up, the attending was like, let's get an ultrasound just in case.
Yeah.
And then we diagnosed it. And then we were able to look out for it a bunch after that too, because he developed several others.
Yeah. Yeah.
Smart attending too. That's awesome. Uh-huh. That's such a great story. Of course, I'm thinking like of so many, like, kind of related, could be anybody, patients who have swelling over a joint and maybe a fever, or maybe just they can't move the joint very well because of the swelling. I think people's heads, at least in emergency medicine and maybe other areas too, go straight to like septic arthritis. And very often it's just a cellulitis or a tendonitis. And it's a huge difference whether, you know, if it's septic arthritis versus tendonitis and cellulitis. And often the workup is like ESR, CRP, kind of inflammatory markers, which are up in all three often, and maybe an orthopedics consult. And so I've actually had to downgrade some orthopedics consults because the plan is like, let's order all this blood work and then let's get an X-ray. And then after the X-ray, let's just get an MRI just to be sure, or to, you know, everything's up, let's get an MRI or a formal ultrasound to make sure, you know. And in the end, if it's just a cellulitis, like you actually don't need any of that, right? Or if it's an abscess in the soft tissue, you just drain it. And if it's a septic joint, you can do an ultrasound guided arthrocentesis sterilely, under sterile precautions, obviously. But anyway, you just made me think of like that whole category. Keep going. Tell me more stories.
Love it. Okay. So when I was in just outpatient clinic, we were having a random wellness checkup with a elder woman. And she had no complaints for the day. Nothing was wrong. No shortness of breath, no pain, no chest pain. And just during the physical exam, this was actually the resident doing it, but I was in there with him. And he's like, this is a little weird. I feel like I could just hear her pulse way louder than I should be like hearing it when I'm listening on exam. And so he checked her pulses and her abdominal pulse was a little bit,
pronounced.
A little bit easier. Yeah, a little bit more pronounced, a little bit easier to feel. And so he was like, I think I have my butterfly kit with me today. And he carries around, he has a butterfly ultrasound with him. So the clinic doesn't have one, but he brought it in. He hooked it up to his iPad and he did it. And we had a 9
centimeter AAA.
9 centimeter.
Oh my gosh.
AAA.
Wow.
Oh my God. And
it was unbelievable. She had no
symptoms
at all. She did not feel it. She did not have any concerns for the visit. And we were able to talk to her about it and send her to the ER because otherwise she would have had no idea. And she didn't meet any of the risk factors really. She wasn't a smoker.
Female?
Yeah, female, exactly. So I don't know. It was crazy.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So that was the coolest one I've seen.
There's a study of how, what's the prevalence, I think, of abdominal aortic aneurysm or AAA in the emergency department. This was done at Yale like many years ago. And I forgot the number, whoever, again, don't know if the person involved in the study would ever listen to this or in the future, but it was some, you know, I want to say 10% or something. And yeah, you have no idea. Asymptomatic. You only know when it's bleeding, which is usually a huge medical emergency. So that's an awesome case.
Yeah. And to be 9 centimeters is crazy, especially to not have any symptoms from it. I remember he was like, come palpate the abdomen and let me know what you think. And I put the back of my hand on the abdomen at one point, and I could feel it like tapping against my hand just from that. Oh, it was unbelievable.
That's really cool, Kate. For the resident too. Medicine resident? Family medicine?
Medicine. Awesome. Yeah, right? To have his own butterfly kit too. I should have referred him over to you.
That's so cool.
Well, I mean, he's clearly on the right track. And that's an example, right? Like, it sounds like maybe he's, you know, doing some independent learning, right? He's got his own butterfly. Mm-hmm. He found this AAA. Worst case scenario is he's wrong, right? But a AAA is very low laying, like, fruit to very easy to diagnose. And he probably saved somebody's life, literally. You both did, you know?
Well, yeah, I was there when he saved someone's life, but I would have done it if
it was just you on an island with an ultrasound and this old lady. You would have saved my life and a vascular surgeon.
Yeah, exactly.
And an OR.
So that was probably the most memorable ultrasound event that I've had so far. Well, we also did see a PE in the ED one time. That was pretty evident, and that was pretty cool to see.
Like right heart strain.
Yeah, exactly. So the little trampoline man at the bottom of the right ventricle.
McConnell sign.
Yeah, McConnell sign.
There you go.
So I remember this,
international viewers. Sorry, how do we clarify that?
Yeah, I don't know if everyone would get the trampoline man, but that's what probably I would get when I was getting taught. The resident taught me that. Because I had never seen it or heard of it before.
Yeah, that's right. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I remember in class, I think we were looking at maybe early pregnancy fetal heartbeat with ultrasound. And I just remembered all your lexicon from your videos. And so we saw like the little...
Cheerio.
Yes. Yep. And I was like, Fruit Loop sign. And you're like, don't call it that.
I did not teach that. I did not teach that. Yeah. I only taught the, and there's no trampoline sign. Yep. There's, nope. Yeah. We just teach that actually. Yeah.
McConnell's. Yeah. So it's really interesting to see as well when we look at these learning opportunities at school, right? We have our radiology sessions and our ultrasound sessions, and we have clear pathologies that we know are going to be pathologies. But then when you get to the ED or you get to clinic and you see these in like real time being diagnosed, it's unbelievable that you can pick it out off of what used to feel like just blobs on a screen. Like the first couple of times I was looking at ultrasound, I was so confused and disoriented. And like just having that background is really, really neat and pretty helpful already. And we're halfway through our first year of clinics.
That's really cool. And your excitement and enthusiasm over it, again, it's contagious. So the more excited you guys are, you know, the more that'll spread and help other people at least be motivated to try to learn it.
Yeah.
Hopefully the right way.
I will say the fetal growth scans that you get to see on ultrasound are in their whole own universe of ultrasound. They are unbelievable. And the technicians that do it are working a spaceship. Like the amount of different buttons and how quickly they do everything, it's unbelievable.
It's impressive.
Yeah. but that's like, I don't know, just part of what's so promising about it is you have something like that, that people are already so excellent at using to diagnose in such a preterm way to catch things before they're actually a problem. There's just so much promise for it down the line too.
Even the fetal surgeries that they do based on findings that they find with ultrasound, you know, like you can do all this in utero and then deliver a child that, you know, doesn't have to go through surgery after, you know, coming into the world. It's incredible.
Yeah. And just like even doing the OB-GYN shelf exams and everything, the amount of problems and treatments and clinical decision-making that occurs because your fundal height doesn't necessarily match your estimated gestational age, before ultrasound, how would you have been able to tell if it's something that was benign or the difference is because of a problem like some sort of polyhydramnios or diabetes, gestational diabetes down the line? But before ultrasound, it's just a dating discrepancy, maybe.
Right. Yeah. So. Yeah, it's crazy. And that's a world I have very little knowledge about, that, you know, again, with like an ultrasound foundation, if you end up going into OB, you know, you would just expand upon, again, that like how to orient a probe and how to recognize normal anatomy. A pregnancy is like, you know, it's just a world in itself of medicine, let alone ultrasound.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you have any memorable stories that stick out to you besides like the first time you really got interested in ultrasound?
Oh my God, I have so many, which is why like I couldn't even contain myself when you were telling me about the hemophilia with the joint effusion. Mm-hmm. Because that's actually something lately that I've just noticed, you know, because I come in overnight and I get sign outs like, oh, this patient's going to get a CT to look for septic joint. And I like just, I almost lose it just because, okay, like why are we doing this when we can, you know, we can rule it out. Obviously, if they're, you know, if they need it on top, once we know after the ultrasound, like if we've ruled it out, we're done. If it's there, I won't get too much into like, I guess, septic joints in general, but there are times that we do need CT. And so I just like to keep it. And for all the radiologists too, I really, you know, being married to one who I support like 1,000%, you know, they want the time to look at the studies that we really need. They don't want to have to get through, like literally last night, my husband read almost 200 studies in an 8-hour shift. So if you do the math, like, most of them are negative. I'm not the radiologist on the other side of the images, but I know hearing over the years, like there are unnecessary studies ordered. And so if we can, again, send a radiologist the ones that we really need, it helps them and it helps us. But in terms of stories, one of my favorites that just comes to mind, of course, after we get off, I'm going to think of like 1,000 others. I have two stories that are definitely in the books is like probably in the top 1% of my favorite stories. One, I guess speaking about pregnancies, and you might hear me say this again in third year, maybe, or fourth year. So a couple years after, it was May 9th, 2013. And I know this to the date because I was almost 9 months pregnant with my son, who was born on May 20th, 2013. And I was working a night shift. It was an overnight shift. I am guessing it was a Friday or Saturday night because it was very busy and there were a lot of traumas. And it's like nice weather. And when it's nice weather on a Friday or Saturday night, people go out and they get into car accidents, et cetera. And I had a guy who was in a car accident and he had neck pain and it was a pretty high mechanism car accident. Although he was not triaged as like a trauma where the whole trauma team comes down. He was in just a room that was very close to our blue pad desk. And he had been driving under the influence of alcohol. And that was something that at times at Hartford, you can actually contact the DMV because they're not only at risk of harming themselves, harming their own life, but also harming others. And that was something that I was starting to do. And he was also kind of a jerk at the time. Like he was intoxicated. He was not respectful, but I kind of just remember thinking to myself, he's got neck pain. He was in a high speed motor vehicle accident. I'm going to make sure he doesn't have a C-spine injury. I'm going to do my best to take care of him because you kind of have to do that. You know, as a physician, you put all the other stuff aside.
Yeah.
And mid workup, The nurse informed me that actually we were both kind of at the nursing desk, and a woman had come in and she was very pregnant, and she looked like she was looking, she looked like she was lost. And I said, can I help you? And she said, oh, I'm looking for so-and-so. And it was the name of this patient that I was taking care of with the neck pain. And I was like, oh, I can take you to him. You know, are you related? Are you a friend? And she said, oh, I'm his wife. And I said, oh, and she was asking how he's doing. And she was kind of like this breath of fresh air at 2 a.m, very pleasant and very pregnant. And I just clicked with her, and her presence immediately made me change my whole kind of thought about him. Like, he's having a bad day. Maybe he doesn't usually drink and drive, you know, like, and this is all kind of split second subconscious thinking that goes on. So I brought her in and I'm continuing on. There's like tons of resuscitations and it's very busy. And all of a sudden, this is when the nurse gets me. The nurse runs up to me and says, the woman in room 16 just passed out. And I didn't even think. I literally grabbed an ultrasound machine on my way to room 16. And she was getting up from the floor and she was holding her abdomen, and she looked like not well, like she had just passed out. And there was a nurse helping her up. And we basically took her to a stretcher. And the moment she laid down, I found the fetus with the ultrasound. And I'm asking her, like, what happened? Are you doing okay? And she's like, I have belly pain. I said, how far along are you? She said, 7 months. And I found the heartbeat, and it was bradycardic at like 50. I think it was 54. And it was no mistake, fetal bradycardia. I put the probe down. They're getting a blood pressure. And again, it's like 2 or 3 a.m. And I call OB. And I said, fetal bradycardia, room 15. And they were down in like 2 minutes. They hadn't even gotten a blood pressure on this woman yet. OB confirmed, the probe's like still there, still gel. They confirmed fetal bradycardia, and she's out of the room. So the entire encounter was probably like 3 to 4 minutes, like literally from the time the nurse told me to OB coming down and whisking her away. And in fetal bradycardia, as you guys probably know, you know, there's concern that there's inadequate blood supply to the fetus, right? So emergency section, she's 7 months. And that's it. I continued on my night. So I still have like 4 or 5 hours to go. And I completely, honestly forgot about her. He had a negative C-spine. He was fine. I learned also, and you'd think that this would be told to me, but there was a passenger in the car that this guy was driving, and it was his brother. And he died in the accident, which also raises, like, why was this not an activated trauma? But this all kind of was a flurry of excitement among probably 30 patients. And it's now after 7 a.m. And the trauma surgeon who was on kind of sidles like next to me. And he was like, hey, great save. And I was like, what are you talking about? And he's like, you know, the ultrasound. And I was like, we have been side to side most of the night. I've done a lot of fast exams. Which, you know, which positive fast are you talking about? Or like, what are you talking about? And he's like, no, the pregnant lady. And immediately I remembered the pregnant lady. And I was like, oh, what happened? And he was like, well, I just talked to so-and-so who is a vascular surgeon. And I guess the story was OB went up to the OR, opened up her peritoneum. And before they got to her uterus, her belly was full of blood.
Oh, wow.
And they saved the baby. And then this vascular surgeon was in the OR next door. They pulled him in and they found a splenic artery aneurysm that had spontaneously ruptured, completely asymptomatic. And they saved her. And splenic artery aneurysm ruptures have a 95% mortality. Like if she was not in the hospital, she would have died. Baby would have died. And she was one at like Hartford Hospital does this like end of the year kind of, I don't know, they pick one or two patients that they feature. And I didn't even know about this. The nurse had told me, so I went. And now at this point I have my son who's like, it was in January. And of course this will happen in May. So my son's like, I don't know, 7 months, and also her daughter was 7 months. And they show pictures of like, I went to visit her in the ICU, but I hadn't, she was very sick at the time. And she like goes up on stage and the baby's up there. And I'm like, I'm just like bawling in the back of the crowd just because like, and anyway, it was all ultrasound. Like, it was entirely like, you know, for whatever reason, like if I hadn't even ultrasounded the baby, like, I don't know, she would have died. The baby would have died. It was just like kind of one of those, like, you have to almost not think mm-hmm. and just act.
That's incredible.
Yeah, that was a cool one.
And to reflect on that has to be pretty unbelievable as well. Just like,
yeah,
like, think of all the steps that led up to that, and to like have that training and to be that person that is ultrasound fluent, and to be the one who was there, and like, I don't know, that's when the stars align for saving something that could have been really, really disastrous.
I wonder too if just the fact that I was pregnant and she was pregnant and I just thought of the baby.
Yeah.
You know, was there a pregnancy component to that? I don't know. And then and the brother died, but if the, you know, if that accident didn't happen, he would have lost his wife and his daughter. It was
wow.
The whole thing was really weird. Not weird, but crazy.
Oh my god.
That is.
Do you think, had that happened now, do you think you would have seen or checked maybe
the hemoperitoneum?
Like, yeah, like, was that a thought initially too? Were you like,
that was what the trauma surgeon, so when the trauma surgeon said NiSave, his thought was like, oh, I must have seen the hemoperitoneum. Yeah. And I was like, I remember there was like this confusion, like he thought I would know immediately. And I was like, what are you talking about? And it took us a while before he said like the pregnant lady, that I realized, because I was
laser
focused on the pregnancy. And because the uterus is so low in the pelvis, and her uterus filled like most of her belly. My focus was primarily just the fetus.
Yeah.
At the time. Now, if the fetus looked fine, I would have continued on to the fast for sure. And like other things, why did she pass out? But when you see fetal bradycardia, like, you know, you just have to act. There's, and you guys probably are aware of this, it sounds like, Riley, you're in like the thick of it on OB, but like, you know, there's things that you, that will get an OBGYN's attention. And you know, as it should, like ruptured ectopic pregnancy, you know, with free fluid in Morrison's pouch, fetal bradycardia. I mean, they see really quite disastrous things. And so because of that, you know, when you see something that's not really a disaster, it doesn't really get their attention. But fetal bradycardia, like, I was floored by how quickly they came down. And the other guy, the other story is much briefer because I don't think I'll remember the details quite as well. But he was 19 and he was a college student from Storrs, I believe. And he went to urgent care. Maybe he just came to the ED. I don't remember. He was put like in the back of the ED, and it was a busy night. And one of my colleagues, who was a simulation fellow, was taking care of, I think picked him up for some reason. And the complaint was leg pain. And nobody had seen him because it was leg pain and he was 19 and healthy and he was in the back of the ED and it was very busy. But for some reason, somebody got an EKG on him and it showed ST elevations and it read STEMI. And so this sim fellow, who's just a couple years, you know, younger than me, came over and she was hilarious. She made me laugh so much, but she pinned me against the wall and pulled up this EKG and she's like, why the hell would a 19-year-old have this? And of course my answer back to her was like, well, did you ultrasound him? And she's like, no, but that doesn't answer the question. And I was like, well, let's go ultrasound him together. And I was thinking myocarditis, you know, there's a lot of things that can cause ST elevation in a young person. Didn't look like he had J-point elevation from like left ventricular hypertrophy, but myocarditis, things like that, which would show you poor LV function. But what we ended up seeing immediately was a gigantic myxoma that filled his entire like left ventricle, and he was just shooting off emboli. And his leg pain was an embolism that had gone down to his leg. So our first encounter with this guy was with an ultrasound machine. And again, for your audience listeners, you should not walk into the room and say, I'm going to ultrasound you as your like first thing. You should take a history and do an exam. But because we looked at his heart, we immediately knew what was, you know, we checked for a pulse. There was no pulse, which also that's something that's important to do right away.
Yeah.
And this guy had kidney failure. He was showering emboli everywhere. 19 years old, had no idea he had the myxoma. And anyway, he had an amputation, I think, as a result. He was transiently on dialysis and then got better and is, from what I understand, is fine now, other than he's fine, you know. So that's
unbelievable.
Right.
Wow.
And his only complaint was leg pain too. Yeah. Anyway, sorry.
When you began telling that story, I wrote down a guess for a diagnosis and I put it in Jack's right pocket. Jack, can you take that out and show the camera?
Oh my God, really?
Oh yeah. Oh, it's mirrored.
You but just need it because I do ultrasound. That's a sign of a good physician right there.
Crazy. No, that's unbelievable though. Like, I think that's the biggest pro to having such a specialty, or I guess not specialty, but like such a extensive background in an imaging that can be so versatile, because you don't have to know what you're looking for to find it sometimes. Like, does that make sense?
It does make sense. I think there are some skeptics who would be, again, I'm always like aware of the skeptics because, and I'm also married to a radiologist, right? And so they're like, oh my God, you can't just like, and people do make mistakes often. Mm-hmm. And I see those in learners. And I think, you know, you say all these nice things like, oh, I have so much experience. But if you think about it, I had zero experience like where you guys are sitting right now. And I also had very limited education as a resident. It was all self-taught. I mean, it's really just like, I try to tell people, like, you do not have to be super smart, you know, to learn ultrasound. You just have to do a lot of it. And the more you can do as a student, as a resident, as a trainee, the more good decisions and like well-informed decisions you're going to make when you're in attending. And that's good for patients. It's good for you. You know, it's good for the system.
Yeah. For these last few minutes here, do you have any recommendations for maybe students who aren't as exposed as they would want to be, like advice or places that they can go to find educational resources to improve their own ultrasound abilities?
Yeah. Well, if you want more ultrasounds, like, and you have feedback on how we can incorporate more in the curriculum, if you're a UConn student, let me know, because I'm always looking for ways to incorporate it. But we have handheld ultrasound devices, which I have no stock in this, but Butterfly IQ is what we purchased at UConn. So you can take one out. You just go to the Sim Center and then you have to email me and I'll set up a login. What I think some students don't take advantage of is if you save images, like there's folders for stage 1, stage 2, and stage 3. If you save images, you can actually put in what you think is going on. You can ultrasound your friends. Obviously, you're not using it for diagnostic purposes. It's going to be for educational purposes. Some people ultrasound like their parents and just for practice. And then you can actually, like, if you email me or text me, I'm happy to look at your ultrasounds and give you feedback if you want it. It's not like it doesn't give me a little signal if you saved one to a folder. So you need to just let me know, like, hey, I saved some, take a look. Even if you've saved a bunch over a week and you want me to take a look, and I can actually give you feedback and it appears in the Butterfly app. So I think, I wonder, you guys probably know better than me, if people are intimidated by that, but you got to remember, like, first of all, I do ask questions as my teaching style, but I'm not a judgy person. And really it just comes down to doing. And I make so, we all make mistakes and we're human and that's how we learn. And the best part is you guys are in your learning phase. Like, believe it or not, even when you're attending, there's still a learning phase, but it's not as like acceptable. So embrace the learning phase and like just be okay. Like, it's okay to be wrong. I feel like that's always hard though for our community. Anyway, but that's how we learn. And I don't judge anybody. I'm happy to hear, you know, if people are interested and want feedback. And then there's lots of great resources. I think the most popular among our residents and many students is 5 Minute Sono. Mm. And the people who make 5 Minute Sono are very, like, they're fellowship trained, and it's all solid information, and it's also in like 5 minute bites. Yeah. I'm working on a website. I feel like I'm always going to say it's in the works. Cause I'm kind of a perfectionist, but
I didn't know if you wanted to bring that up or not. It was kind of a provoked, you can plug this now if you want to, but like, it's such a great resource because we used it for Sono Slam and for a couple other different things, just because we were able to review it before it was actually published. And it's so good for educational purposes in terms of like seeing a pathology. It's essentially what we do in the VAL lab. Just, you can do it at home on your computer and it's live time. It's not like an Anki snapshot that you're just clicking through. Like, you can see the actual ultrasound video, and there's a lot of pathologies on there. So I think that'll be really good whenever it does become available.
Yeah. I mean, it's technically available. It's just, I feel like there's so much more that can be put on it. And so,
there always is.
Yeah. But yeah, it might be my Instagram, like, logoname.com.
Okay. Okay. Well, do you have anything last second here? I know the time's running out, so.
I don't. I'm really appreciative of your time, and you know, we love being able to interact with you over these last few years. It's been awesome.
It's a blessing, really. It makes this curriculum way better. So, seriously, thank you for your time, and thank you for everything you've done for us. I'm excited to kind of pay it forward, start teaching maybe the attendings one day.
That's great.
The reverse education.
Every interaction, you're teaching the attendings something, believe it or not. But yeah, no, it was a pleasure. Thank you for being interested in talking to me and talking about ultrasound. I appreciate it always. And yeah, you guys are great. So it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bye.